You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Rube McLaren tōku ingoa, nō mai hare mai ki te Wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Monday the 14th of May. I'm joined in the studio by Mary Margaret Slack and Lucy Austin. How was your weekend?
Pretty good, thanks.
Yep, pretty good, pretty lazy.
I don't even remember what I did now. It's at that point in semester.
What did you have for breakfast?
Oh, yogurt, banana, frozen raspberries.
How millennial.
Thanks.
We've got a packed show today. First up, Lucy checks in with the Vice Chancellor of Auckland University, Stuart McCutcheon. We catch up with Green Party co-leader James Shaw and talk about the likelihood of compulsory Te Deo and a funding boost for predator control. We have Southern Cross with David Robbie, where we'll hear about the Timor-Leste elections and the prospect of Bougainville independence. And Mary Margaret learns about the deepfake technology with Victoria University senior media design lecturer. If you have any thoughts to share, send us a text on 5395 or give us a call on 309 3879.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
In light of recent events such as the library closures and funding to arts being repeatedly cut, I thought it was important to have a chat with the man in charge himself, the Vice-Chancellor of Auckland University, Stuart McCutcheon. The most significant criticism has been a lack of communication with both students and staff. With BFM being the university radio station, it seemed an appropriate platform to open up the dialogue and get to know the Vice-Chancellor a bit better. This is part of a two-part series. The second half focuses on the library closures specifically and construction work. This will be played on the Wednesday Wire, 12 to 1, with Lillian, ahead of the Rally for a New University protest on Thursday, which has come off the back of the Save Our Libraries protest. I started this interview by asking Stuart to tell us a little bit more about how he came to the role.
Well, I'm the first member of my family ever to go to university. I was fortunate to have parents who, although they didn't have that opportunity, were keen on tertiary education for their children. So they made it clear that all of us were going to tertiary education of some kind, which we all did. I ended up as a university lecturer, oddly enough, and then somehow progressed from being a lecturer to a head of department, to a deputy vice-chancellor, to the vice-chancellor of Victoria University in Wellington, and then of Auckland. And I've been here for 12 or 13 years.
Yeah, so you came to the role in 2005, and what's been your main goal for the university over this time, and how has it changed maybe?
Well, I think all of us would hold to the view that New Zealand needs to have at least one really good university, and we are currently, of course, the top-ranked university in New Zealand, not only as the university itself, but also in most of the subjects we teach. But we're ranked 80th in the world in the QS rankings, and I think in danger of continuing to slip, as all the New Zealand universities are. So our real challenge is, how do you create a great university for New Zealand, but do so with what are very modest funding resources by the standards of most Western countries?
So what's your real vision for the university?
I think if you look at what the great universities of the world do, they take in very talented students, but they also address the issue of those whose personal circumstances don't allow them to exhibit their own natural ability. They add real value to those students during the study process, but also in their extracurricular life, and so they produce great graduates who go on to be citizens of New Zealand, leaders and citizens of the world, and they create the kind of research that makes a real difference to people's lives. And that's what we need this university to be able to do. But like most things in life, good quality costs money. And so the issue of how we resource that, how do we pay for all those things, is an important issue for us.
Yeah, massively so. So there's been some criticism recently about the focus on STEM subjects.
Mm-hmm.
Over the arts, especially in the last 5 years. What would you say to people with those concerns?
I don't think that there really has been a focus on STEM over the arts, at least not in the university. There's certainly been some view in the previous government that it wanted to increase the number of students in the STEM subjects. And so it tried to send some signals by the way of the funding mechanism that favoured the STEM subjects over the arts. But you have to appreciate that the university takes all of that money and assigns it across the faculties in the way that tries to do the most good. So I think we buffered out that particular issue. What we have seen, though, is a reduction in the number of students want to study the arts and education and social work in particular.
And why do you think that is?
I think there's a couple of things going on. I think the global financial crisis made people think about the importance of getting a good job as opposed to doing the things they were interested in. I think there has been some government signalling.
Do you think there's some... there's a view that you can't get a good job with the arts?
No, I think if you look at the numbers, I mean, we're not talking about massive flight from the arts. We're talking about numbers that are measured in a few hundreds in a university that has 42,000 students. But it's enough at the margins to get the Faculty of Arts or the Faculty of Education and Social Work into some financial difficulty. So I think it is about people at the margins. If you always wanted to be a classicist, that's what you're going to do. If you're wondering about whether to do science or French, you might think, and I'm good at both, but there's a better job in science, and at the margin, that's the choice you make. From the university's point of view, I think it's important to remember that we have supported the Faculty of Arts and the Faculty of Education and Social Work significantly in recent years to help them get through the funding difficulties. Mm-hmm. So we've put money into their budgets that wasn't justified by their student numbers to try and cut the bottom off the trough, if you like, and give them time to recover. In the case of arts, they've recovered somewhat with new programs. In the case of education and social work, falling numbers continue to be a big problem. And that's mostly about people not being as keen on teaching as a profession as they used to be. And if you look at the remuneration that teachers receive, if you look at the challenges of being a teacher in the modern school environment, then I think that's kind of understandable.
Yeah, absolutely. Why is it important to invest in STEM subjects?
Well, it's important to invest in all subjects. It's not important just to invest in STEM subjects. What you want in a comprehensive university is an investment across the board. Many of our top students take conjoint degrees, so they are often in two faculties at once. We're just doing graduation this week. We see lots of students coming across, for example, with an arts and law degree or an arts and commerce degree or a science and commerce degree and so forth. But also many of the challenges that we have in research require all of the disciplines. So you can't solve climate change from a purely scientific angle. It helps, but it's also to do with people's behaviours and attitudes and values. And so many of the challenges the university faces in its research, many of the things it tries to help people address, are multidisciplinary. And for that reason, we see and have always seen that the University of Auckland is a comprehensive university and that it should have a range of disciplines. And that's why we haven't been driven solely by market forces. If we had been, arts and education and social work would be smaller than they are, but we have protected them because we do think that a comprehensive university is important.
So coming on to fees, what's the reason for the fee increases then? Where's this money going and what will it provide to students?
Sure. So if you want to think about the university from a financial point of view, we have a budget of about $1.2 billion a year. About $600 million of that goes in staff costs. On the revenue side, our revenue comes from government subsidy of domestic students. It comes from domestic student fees, it comes from international student fees, and it comes from research. And then there's a few other bits and pieces along. The fundamental problem the university has, and all universities in New Zealand have, is that our costs, and particularly our people costs, are rising at a faster rate than our income. So people costs go up because of general increases in wages. They go up because we have to compete internationally for staff, particularly academic staff. They go up because our staffing profile is somewhat aging and becoming more senior. On the revenue side, government controls its own contribution, usually to at most 1-2% a year, and it controls what we can charge domestic students in the same way. Now, if you have your costs, particularly your people costs, rising more quickly than your revenue, what are you going to do? One obvious solution would be to say, well, let's have fewer people per student. In other words, let's make our classes bigger. But the problem there is that you will reduce quality of teaching, and also the rankings are driven to some extent by the staff-student ratio, so your rankings will fall. Then you won't attract international students, then you'll use that revenue. So what we've tried to do is to maintain the quality of teaching, to maintain class sizes, the number of academics relative to the numbers of students, and then to get cost out of the administration. So when student fees go up, they do not go up by enough to meet the reasonable cost increases of the university. That's what you have to understand. Everything goes becomes more expensive. That's why I call it inflation.
Yeah.
But the constraint on student fees means that we don't meet the increase in staffing costs from student fees and the government subsidy. And therefore, we have to find ways of getting other costs out of the place in order to maintain our class sizes and our numbers of academics.
And how has the government's initiative to make the first year of university free affected the university?
Well, it's had really no effect at all, except that it's added cost.
Yeah.
So we don't see an increase in student numbers, and more particularly, we don't see an increase in the number of students from disadvantaged communities, which is what the policy ostensibly was aimed at. So the government is spending across the whole tertiary sector about $600 million a year on this policy. The only effect that it will have is to lower levels of student debt for students who graduate. It won't help the university funding, it won't help the quality of what we do, and I don't think it will help significant numbers of students from disadvantaged communities come to university either.
So I myself am an arts major. I'm doing politics and English, and I'm also an international student, if my accent didn't already give it away. You've talked about the importance of attracting international students to better the quality of the university and the rankings. I myself came over in 2016, greeted by lots of tutors, and now in the second year that was no longer the case. What do you say to these students who are paying like a significant amount and have seen these resources go?
Well, I think what's happened in the arts faculty, the arts and education are a particular case. What's happened there is that the number of students has fallen, and so the faculty has preserved, if you like, the establishment academic positions by cutting the tutoring budget, and that's a sensible first approach. You either cut the amount of money that's available for discretionary staffing, or you cut the permanent staffing. I mean, you have to do something, because you haven't got the money.
Yeah.
So that's what the faculty did in the first instance. We've realised that the numbers of students aren't going to recover fast enough to reverse that problem. And so we are having a discussion in the faculty with how we address that issue. But the New Zealand system, and it's true in most parts of the world, the New Zealand system is one where the revenue is driven by the number of students, but the number of students can fall more quickly than the number of staff will fall naturally. And so it's how you balance that exercise. Having said all that, the satisfaction rates from our surveys of international students are well above 90%. Both international students and domestic students give us very high ratings for pretty well everything. The only thing we don't get high ratings for, I think, is Wi-Fi. No matter how much Wi-Fi you supply, you can never supply enough. But the fact that we've grown our international student numbers by 5 to 7% a year consistently in recent years, I think says that international students, like the domestic students, are getting very good value for money. Although in your case, you're seeing a local problem in arts, which is a function of the change in student numbers. If you look at the ranking of New Zealand universities relative to their cost, what you see is that we are the most efficient ranking university system in the world.
I'm paying less here in international fees than I'm paying in the UK.
So your value for money proposition is pretty good, but I can understand perfectly that a short-term change in the amount of the tutoring budget has an impact on students. But that's what you're seeing is a problem of how we get from where we are now to where we need to be in a sustainable position in the long term.
So around, up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire. It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
Hi, James. How are you today?
Yeah, good, mate. Good.
Good to have you on. So, to start off with, we'll talk compulsory Te Reo. So, Manama Davidson is pushing strongly to make Te Reo compulsory in all public primary and secondary schools by 2030. And this differs from the government stance, which only calls for universal availability and integration of Te Reo in primary schools. Ardern also has been avoiding the term compulsory. Furthermore, Winston Peters said Māori Development Minister Nanea Mahuta isn't speaking for the government policy full stop when she discussed how to achieve compulsory Te Reo. So things aren't looking too good for the Green Party policy of compulsory Te Reo. If the government isn't supportive, how will the Green Party achieve it?
Well, it's a process, and frankly, we've got so far to go on this. There's been considerable improvement in the last 20 years in New Zealand, but there's a hell of a long way to go. And so, the idea that we'd get through a staged process, Even getting to universal availability, frankly, would be a pretty major step in the right direction. And then I guess the Green Party would want to build on that and go to eventually getting every kid taught that alongside English.
So would the Greens accept universal availability by 2025 as the government's proposing?
Well, if we can get universal availability by 2025, that would be, frankly, a huge step. I mean, when we've said that we wanted to move towards compulsory te reo, that's over quite a long time period because we just don't have the teachers at the moment and the resources available to do that. And so, you know, whether you move to that universal access and then up to compulsory, you've still got to have this kind of pipeline of teacher training and development coming through. You've got to have kind of champions and schools, you know, all of that kind of stuff has got to be put in place in order to be able to deliver on it. It's not something you can just flick the switch today and say this is what we want tomorrow. So that's always been our stance, that we wanted to move towards that. And I guess I would say that, you know, universal availability would certainly be one of the steps along the way.
Yeah, I suppose that reflects Nanea Mahuta's comments that the first step is getting more teachers proficient in te reo in schools. But do you think the government feels that just at the moment, at least, there isn't enough public support for compulsory te reo?
Well, it's really interesting. My sense is that the ground has really shifted on this. I mean, I remember when I was in school, and I was in what was then called Standard 3, I think I was about 8 or whatever it was, and said, can we learn this? And I kind of got scoffed at, and that was kind of in the early mid-1980s. And my sense is that actually, there is broad public acceptance for it. It was interesting to me during the election campaign last year, when I was doing my kind of stump speech in different parts of the country, that was one of the ones that actually got some of the greatest support up and down the country. So my sense is that actually, things really have changed and New Zealanders' perception of who we are and what makes us unique has really changed, and I think there's a real hunger for it now.
Alrighty, and now on to pest control. So a couple of days ago, the Green Party Conservation Minister Eugenie Sage announced that there will be a $20 million funding boost to predator control, bringing the total to about $80 million over 4 years. So can you tell us a bit more about this package?
Yeah, so this is pretty significant. What it does is it enables the Department of Conservation to almost double the amount of land that it looks after on an ongoing basis to about 1.8 million hectares. That's an area from kind of Auckland all the way up to the top of Northland. That's an area the size of that spread across the whole country. It's also really significant because it's baseline funding. And what that means is that it's available to the Department of Conservation every year. And that's going to make a huge difference because previously the government only funded the Department of Conservation in one-year increments whenever there was what they call a mast year, which is a year when essentially there's a lot of food lying around for predators and a sort of a growth in their population, which then would be arrested. But what happened as a result of the way that was funded is it meant that actually the kind of birds and other native wildlife that were at risk never really got the chance to bounce back and to recover. And what this funding does is it actually gives them a chance of recovering.
And so, a lot of this funding is going to community groups. So how would that work?
Well, I mean, this has always been the way with the Department of Conservation, but there's been a significant increase in public participation in conservation efforts and in predator control efforts. And, all over the country, you've now got sort of local community groups who are putting in huge amounts of effort into predator control in their areas. And a number of them are, really quite sophisticated operations. And it kind of multiplies the effort that the Department of Conservation themselves are able to do. So, it's a great way for kind of, regular New Zealanders to get involved in conservation efforts.
So would you call this a big win for the Greens?
Look, it's a huge win. The Department of Conservation has seen its baseline funding shredded over the past decade, and this really restores it, and it restores it in an area which is vitally needed. We've got just over 80% of our native wildlife is at risk of extinction. And so the idea that the Department of Conservation is getting the largest boost to its frontline predator control efforts since, I think, 2002, you know, I think it's going to make a massive difference.
Some of the funding would also be used to develop new methods of technological predator control. Do you know exactly what that might look like?
Well, I mean, I can't say what all of it's going to go to, because, you know, you are talking about some things that are still on the drawing board, or you know, just a kind of a concept at the moment. But there are new technologies that are emerging all the time. For example, I've got a New Zealand developed trap at home, which is a sort of a resetting trap that you know, when a possum sticks its head in it and gets killed, it kind of opens again. The possum's body drops out and it resets, and, you know, kind of goes until the gas bottle runs out, which is you know, quite a long time. And that was developed in New Zealand and is actually now being exported for predator control all over the world. And so those kinds of initiatives, I think, the more of those that we can have that kind of work and help us to kind of scale up our efforts, given the scale of the challenge of becoming predator-free by 2050, you know, you've got to say, you know, what's out there that we can accelerate.
Also, it seems the funding seems to focus mostly on protecting our cute winged friends that people hold most dear. But what about the variety of native insects and plants that often make up the majority of the most endangered species list?
Yeah, well, this is why it's so important for the Department of Conservation to have its baseline funding restored, is because the voluntary groups and the non-profits and private enterprise often go after the kind of, you know, hero kind of areas or animals and birds and so on, and actually, it's, you know, the Department of Conservation has got a sort of a responsibility, no matter how charismatic the fauna are that they're protecting, to look after it, and I think that's, you know, again, it's just a good argument for making sure that it's got the funding necessary to be able to do its baseline job.
And predator-free 2050, how realistic do you think that is?
Well, it's a significant challenge, right? But I think that it is achievable, but it is going to take significant resourcing over the coming three decades if we're going to have any hope of it. And this was always our complaint about, you know, when the National Party launched this, is that they kind of had the vision and the kind of the byline for it, but they didn't put any significant funding into it. And you know, I mean, it is just a massive challenge for the country. And so, you know, we have to resource it as such if we're serious about it.
All righty. Well, thank you very much, James, for coming on.
No worries. Thanks for having me on the show.
We'll talk to you next time.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party.
The Wire. I should be a DJ. It's just choosing songs, and I'm so good at choosing.
Whoa! Reckon you've got what it takes to select an excellent tune? Ready to make the call? Listen in to 95BFM Breakfast every weekday. Text in your pick for final call, breakfast's final track of the day, and be in to win a Yui Boom every week thanks to our mates at Orcon Broadband. Plus, all the choicest tunes live on in the 95BFM Final Call Spotify playlist. Many make the call, few are chosen.
Ah, this is a bit awkward, eh?
Yeah, blind dates.
Did you see the new Transformers movie?
Nah.
Some weather we're having.
Yeah, surf on the West Coast is an absolute zero.
Oh my God, do you surf? That is so sexy.
Well, I like to say informed. Yesterday, zero. Oh. Day before, one. But last Tuesday, it was a four. Major swells. Epic.
Don't stop. I love this.
Shaka.
The 95 BFM Surf Report. All the surf, all the time. Brought to you by Pro Gear Professional Photographics.
Now it's time for the Southern Cross.
With us in the studio today, we have Professor David Robbie, Director of Pacific Media Centre, and a postgraduate student journalist from the PMC Asia Pacific Report, Rahul Batarai. David, a lot of things have been happening in the Asia-Pacific region over the past few days. Let's start with the Timor-Leste elections on Saturday. Things have been fairly fractious with a political deadlock for months. Has this deadlock been broken by the elections?
Yes, well, fairly decisively, and this is what people were really hoping for, because over the past year, the government that was actually in place, which is the Fretilin Party, which is the pro-independence group that fought for independence against Indonesia for 24 years or so, they had a minority government. And they couldn't get their program through. They couldn't get their budget through or any of their major things that they were trying to do. So they were blocked with the budget twice. And so this is the second election that's been held in less than a year. So people were pretty fed up with it and hoping that there will be a decisive result. And yes, they have. The opposition AMP, which is a grouping of three main parties, including a youth party, have come out top. And they got pretty well almost the final results was 49, about, you know, almost the full electoral returns have come in. So the AMP had 49%, and which translates to 34 seats in the 65-seat parliament. Fretilin is still the largest single party. They got 34%, which is pretty well much the same as what they got in the last election, but they've only got 23 seats this time, so they're out of government. And it was actually really much about a style of what to do for the future, because Timor-Leste has only got its oil reserves and the Timor Gap. And once that oil and gas runs out, there's virtually no income for the country of just over a million people. AMP are rather focused on major development projects, whereas perhaps the Fretilin were more concerned with rural development. So it was a really interesting result.
So do you think that majority is enough to mean that we'll have significant progress?
Well, certainly AMP have now got a free hand, more or less, to follow through their policies. The question now is whether it's the right sort of policies for the future of the country. So the debate will go on.
And the future is fairly uncertain for Bougainville, with the independence vote looming sometime next year. But two important court cases are coming up this week about the future of mining. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, well, that's basically around the future of Panguna Mine. You'll recall that there was a 10-year civil war fought in Bougainville over Panguna Mine, over environmental issues, and also because of the landowners not getting a fair deal from the mining company, which is BCL, then at that time owned by Rio Tinto. This is really the crux of the independence vote for next year. What happens to Panguna, and will there be mining? Because so many, 20,000 lives were lost as a result of that war, and so the country is split in a way. Well, the territory rather is split. I mean, many people in Bougainville want to be an independent country, of course, but they're not at the moment. They're an autonomous region. So for these two court cases, they're very critical. And in a sense, they're happening on the same day, Thursday, this coming Thursday, but in two different places, Port Moresby and Melbourne. And the Port Moresby one is about essentially about what the autonomous region government has actually been able to. They've got a moratorium at the moment, and so BCL is challenging that. And then the one in Melbourne is really about there's a company that's backed by Philip Mariori, who represents many of the landowners, and they're pushing this other company, basically saying that BCL did their thing, and really the Bougainville suffered enormously as a result, and even the civil war was a result of BCL's very bad policies. So they want a bar of BCL again. But the other company that they've been promoting is based in Australia and Philippines and so on. So BCL are challenging them about their credibility and about whether they should have any stake at all. So people will be watching very closely what the result of these two court cases this week.
And Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister has warned foreigners shouldn't treat the prospects of an independent Bougainville as a plaything that New Zealand and Australia have become obsessed with. What do you think, what does this mean, and should New Zealand and Australia play a role in it?
Well, New Zealand played a key role, you know, in bringing in the peace with the Burnham Agreement and so on. And it should be prepared to play a very positive role in the future. Personally, as a journalist who has written about these issues for a very long time, in fact, I covered the Bougainville War right on the first two years, 1989-90 and so on. I've strongly believe myself that Bougainville should be independent and did have the basis of it, and it was the strongest in it was called the North Solomon's Province in those days, and it was the strongest economy within Papua New Guinea itself. And there's a very strong case for it being independent, and New Zealand should really support whatever the result of the referendum is next year.
So media freedom has been a big topic over the last couple of weeks, and the second Pacific Media Summit has just concluded in Tonga. What was the result of this, and are we going to see any changes?
Well, I think there's a lot of talk without very great deal of results at all. Ironically, it's this Pacific Media Summit was in Tonga, where the Tonga current Tongan government under Prime Minister Akalisa Puheva is strongly being criticised for its rather repressive approach to the media, trying to shut down the media anytime there's any serious questions, getting rid of staff on the Tonga Broadcasting Commission, which is the state broadcaster, and so on. And so complaint after complaint in terms of media freedom issues. But I guess that probably the thing that we probably focused on most was actually something a bit lighthearted from the conference, because a jealousy sort of spat developed between Samoa and Tonga. And it was largely Akalisa Puheva, the Prime Minister of Tonga, was very peeved off that that Samoa was better placed in the RSF World Press Freedom Index. So basically Tonga's about 51st, and it sort of dropped down a couple of places. And Samoa went up one place to 22nd. So it was well above Tonga. But basically the Prime Minister of Samoa, Tuilapa, he had this comment about, Puheva's a bit jello about our media better media freedom stakes and so on. So people sort of took that as a bit of a joke, really. But we'll be certainly watching the space. I mean, I think there was a big concern about the future of media freedom in Tonga.
And why have Tonga dropped a few places? Is there a big disparity between Tonga and Samoa in terms of media freedom?
Well, these things are always open to argument. Is Samoa really that a good example of media freedom compared with Tonga? And it's, of course, much higher than Papua New Guinea, and certainly a lot higher than Fiji. But others would argue that both Papua New Guinea and Fiji have much stronger media. Personally, I think that there's much closer similarity between Tonga and Samoa. But what Samoa has got is this enormously strong independent newspaper in the Samoa Observer, which is one of the best papers in the Pacific, and that alone carries the cudgels of media freedom in Samoa.
Thank you, David. And we'll move on to you now, Raul. You were reporting on the pro-Palestine Nakba demonstration down at Auckland Silo Park yesterday as part of the Asia-Pacific coverage. The protesters were demonstrating against 70 years of occupation by Israel, and today is Israel Day. Can you tell us about your experience? What was the turnout like?
We're expecting more people than what turned up yesterday, but it was definitely good. Protesters were loud, and they definitely had their voices go across the other side of the fence. And they did not break any law. They were loud enough, and they were very. It was a very peaceful protest.
And what were some of their concerns?
Oh, I think they were not happy with the Israelis celebrating 70 years of their birthday, because on the other side, there are a lot of Palestinians. They are being kicked out from their homes and evicted. I actually spoke to one of the Palestinian guys whose father was evicted under a gunpoint when he was 12 years old. So those are the types of people who came in there to show their support to the Palestinians.
Yeah, and you're a new postgraduate student journalist after graduating from Auckland University. I understand this was your first published assignment in Asia-Pacific report. How do you feel about it?
Oh, God, it was amazing. But just to correct you, I'm from Massey University, not Auckland.
Sorry about that.
No, that's absolutely fine. When I had my article published, it was an amazing experience. I did work quite a lot with David here, and he helped me. He guided me through all the way, including baby steps. So, and being in the middle of the protest yesterday was... it was an amazing experience. It was a great experience. I was right there in the front line where the police were stopping the protesters, and they're also other side. The Zionists were having their own celebration going on while there was a protest on the other side.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your assignment?
I did not necessarily take one point of view. However, I did lean towards Palestinian because I could interview a lot of people on that side. And they were very upset about how there are not many people who are supporting them here in New Zealand, and they came here to support. They came here to get the support of New Zealand government.
Excellent. Thanks for coming in. I really, really appreciate it, David and Marul. Southern Cross is taking a little break from us now until the start of the second semester in mid-July. However, you can still keep up with the Asia Pacific news and analysis at Pacific Media Centre, www.pmc.aut.ac.nz, or at asiapacificreport.nz. Thank you very much.
That was the Southern Cross.
That was Essential 4 by Soulwax. You're listening to The Wire. The time is 15 minutes to 1. We had a text in regarding compulsory Tadeo in schools. Peter says, why use force to condition the minds of children? It is so wrong on so many levels and an uninvolved approach to life. Cheers, Peter. More freedom, less government. I take it you're adverse to any form of government-sanctioned education then? We'd love to know. Alrighty.
They are nicking our shit. They totally are.
The Wire.
The rise of internet and advanced technology has seen the emergence of deep fake videos. People's faces can be edited onto a completely different person's body in a video. For example, there are several YouTube clips of Barack Obama saying things that Barack Obama has never actually said, and of actors performing sex acts that they never have done in front of a camera. Clearly, this poses an immense danger, so why were the deepfakes invented? Do they offer positive aspects? I asked Victoria University's senior media design lecturer, Tom White, if we have sufficiently legal framework to deal with deepfakes.
I'm a senior lecturer here in the media design department, and we teach computational design. So I teach people how to express themselves creatively using computer and computer codes. Traditionally, that's been programming, scripting, but more and more recently, that includes these AI techniques. So 2 years ago, in October of 2016, I was teaching a graduate level class to our master's students, and I was teaching some of these techniques, and one of our master's students at the time, Jono Bishop, he used some of these techniques to basically do the first deep fake. So this was he wasn't doing it on real imagery. He was taking a rendered face and then he was swapping in a realistic face using a deep neural network. But to my knowledge, that's the first sort of use of the technology of deep fakes. They've captured the public imagination more recently because they've been popularized in a different context and banned from a lot of online message boards. So I believe the first place this came up was on Reddit, and they had a deepfake image board. And what people were essentially doing was doing face swaps with porn. So you would have a porn actress, and the face would be swapped out with another actress or with someone else. Really, the technology is agnostic to the context it's being deployed in. And in fact, it's not even specific to faces. Like, you can use the same deep neural networks on data sets of logos or fonts or other things. But this particular application is what's caused the controversy.
So before we get into the controversy, what are some of the positive aspects of deepfake, and what kind of developments does it offer as we enter our AI future?
If you back away from deepfake, so deepfakes, as they've kind of been understood, involved the swapping of faces into an image, and specifically into video. And that's useful in if someone's creating a movie or creating that. And this isn't really a new technique. This, if you go to Weta or the other big special effects companies, they do these techniques. I believe, and I should look up this reference, but I believe at Weta a few years ago, they had an actor die before filming was complete, and so they shot the rest of the film with someone else and swap the face in. And this isn't, you know, completely new technique. I think what's changed is that the accessibility of these tools have become easier. But when you step back from the application of deepfakes, what you have is you have a system that's able to create media or create imagery without the same type of interface. So instead of, you know, going into Photoshop or one of these tools to sort of explicitly state each pixel or sort of put everything in place, you can set higher level goals for the image. And like I said, this applies to logo design, it applies to fonts, it applies to all sorts of any structured data set. You could use this to synthesize new imagery.
One deepfake developer has said that he wants to democratize this work so that no technical knowledge is required and anyone could use a photo of someone's face and put it on, as you mentioned before, a pornographic clip. Mm-hmm. So moving into the legal side of things, this isn't only identity theft, but it's an acceleration of what we've seen recently with revenge porn. Do you think that there are sufficient legal frameworks to deal with these threats, or is the technology moving faster than society is?
I know at least one of the concerns that I saw online around this was with child pornography, because the laws around child pornography are very strong, and I believe someone was concerned that they had swapped it. They were using some source imagery from Harry Potter, and some of the actors in Harry Potter weren't of a certain age, and so I think that there's certain parts that people are tracking the laws on this, but I think that the laws are still being sort of playing catch up. And one thing just to clarify is, I guess the technology is very new, but I guess the application is sort of older. So if you think about how photo editing happened 20 years ago, it was being happening in a dark room, and people were cutting out images and they were gluing them on. And I mean, this was maybe 30 years ago. This is how you would do manipulation of photography. And then Photoshop came along and democratized it. And there was a lot of these same concerns at the time about, you know, how will we know what's real and what's not. I think what I was trying to say with the example with the special effects is that as a technique, swapping in faces has existed for a long time. But there is a new technology, the technology of generative neural networks, and this is what's sort of in this analogy becoming the new Photoshop. So you have a new technology which allows not, you know, a high budget production movie to do this, but it allows a cheaper, maybe for now not as high quality version of this to exist from anyone that's motivated enough to do it.
Mm. But if we're saying that, do you think it has more of a place in the private sphere than the public sphere?
I think that the technology to create these is sort of already, it's in the public domain. Like there are research papers that are published that explain this. So I think that the difference maybe, I meant not so much public and private, is just expense. I think to do this before, it would have taken a large budget, and you would have had to hire multiple animators to do this by hand, whereas now you can have the computer kind of do it automatically for you.
Do you think that it's reasonable to view this as another step in an overall societal move to post-truth politics?
I wouldn't characterize it as that. And again, we are outside of my specialty, but I think that I specialize in media design and in creating media, and I think in that domain we have seen these things happen before, and I think Photoshop is a strong reference. That said, you know, we went through the transition into Photoshop pretty well, and as a society I think people are even comfortable using Photoshop as a verb now, like, you know, this image looks Photoshopped. If you know, 20 years ago it wasn't clear how that was going to evolve. I think that now we're going into a similar step where the technology is changing quickly. And it will take some time for this to become public knowledge and for us to sort of adapt the norms around how these things are used.
Do you have any final comments about this whole topic?
I think my main thing that I would like to add is to keep in mind that deepfakes is one particular niche application at the corner of this technology. So there's the ability to swap faces, and that could be used for deepfakes, but it could also be used for someone to generate other videos on YouTube or other, if you're any video that you're making might be enhanced by being able to swap identities out. And so there is a use for this in a creative context. But even stepping back further, you know, that this isn't confined to faces. This is a new technology that will make all kinds of media production easier. I think that what's happened is that one particular, this is caught on in one small community and cause some issues, but I think that what we'll probably see is we'll probably see this technology blossoming in other areas that aren't specific to face swapping.
That was Victoria University's Tom White, a senior lecturer of media design. He is one of the few people familiar with deepfake videos, which undoubtedly pose threats to identity, consent, and defamation. Should we open up this discourse to the legal sector? Is law reform needed to deal with AI changes? Give us a text if you have some thoughts on 5395.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
It's your Kiwaha o Te Wiki, your saying of the week. This week,
ha ha te tahua, got no money.
We're heading off to Munchie Mart, you coming?
Nah, mate. Ha ha te tahua. Ha ha te tahua, got no money.
It's your Kiwaha o Te Wiki, brought to you by Ngāta Wira Māori.
Want to pursue your academic passions? After some high-level career opportunities? About to finish your undergrad and terrified of the world outside? Wonderful! May 21st to 25th is Postgrad Week at the University of Auckland, and it's packed with information sessions and opportunities for one-on-one advice. Get into the nitty-gritty of postgraduate study and find answers for all your difficult questions. Postgrad Week at the University of Auckland, May 21st to 25th. Register now at postgradweek.ac.nz.
Putting the sass and brass back into sassafras.
Brass isn't in sassafras.
Well, it is now. Tammy Nielsen is back with a brand new album, Sassafras, and it's a banger. Now she's bringing it to the Auckland Town Hall. If you want to win yourself some tickets, then just stay tuned to BFM all this week. Stay out of my business. 95 BFM presents Tammy Nielsen, Sassafras New Zealand Tour, Saturday, August 4th, Auckland Town Hall. Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster.
You're listening to The Wire. The time is 5 minutes to one. We've just had a reply from Peter. He says, State Force education can ensure that notions of self-love doesn't become a social norm. From there, force and control are relatively easy to sell. Cheers, Peter. More freedom, less government. Other listeners, what do you reckon? Let us know.
Brother, you will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
That was The Wire.
Yes, indeed. That was another Monday Wire. That's it for today. Thanks to producers Lucy and Mary Margaret, and thanks to everyone that came on today. James Shaw, Stuart McCutcheon, David Robbie, Rahul Bhattadai, and Tom White. That's your Monday Wire. We'll catch you next week. Penny's up next with the 1 to 4. We'll be right back.
95 BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.